Coming up in this podcast, iron ore, Rio AGM, infrastructure spending, karate ruling, house prices, private deals, and the new boss of Frio Ports.
Welcome to Mark My Words, the weekly podcast from Business News, with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer discussing the important business news and data stories from Western Australia.
Welcome to our weekly podcast, and welcome Mark Beyer. Mark, firstly, iron ore has hit a new record since we last spoke.
The rise and rise of iron ore continues. It was only a week ago we were looking at the price and seeing whether it might have hit a record last week. Well, absolutely, it's now hit a record above $200 a ton for the benchmark price. Great news for the mining industry in Western Australia. Great news for governments around the country. Royalties will be pouring into the WA Treasury's coffers. Similarly, federal government, yes. Their budget will be handed down next week, and they'll be, I'm sure, revising their revenue forecasts as the iron ore price keeps on going up. And against the backdrop of continuing tensions with China, which, of course, is the major market for iron ore. So it's very telling. During the week, the Chinese government came out and announced that they were suspending meetings of what they call the China-Australia Strategic Economic Dialogue. The statement talked about Australia having a Cold War mindset and ideological discrimination against China. We think the trigger for this was when the federal government intervened and scrapped the deal between Victoria and China for the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yep. But which hadn't gone anywhere anyway.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of this stuff is very symbolic. In fact, Matt McKenzie spoke to Jeffrey Wilson at the Perth US Asia Centre, and he talked about the fact that this strategic and economic dialogue body had not met since 2017.
Yeah, right. So we'll scrap something that doesn't don't use anyway.
But isn't that telling? China, a global superpower, is clearly very grumpy with Australia, but it's left with very little things that it can do when it has to resort to symbolic gestures like this. Obviously, they've already put in place a lot of trade sanctions in other industries, and some of them have hit. You know, we talked about wine just last week, where the big tariffs have hit Australian wine producers.
Yeah.
But the big one is iron ore.
Yep.
And this is where we've got this mutual dependence. China is our biggest market for iron ore, and we're their biggest supplier. And when you think about, too, the price of iron ore, I mean, it's driven in a substantial part by the infrastructure spending happening within China itself.
That's right.
And in fact, the Chinese steel mills have record profit margins at the moment. So despite paying more for iron ore, they're clearly getting a good price for their product at the other end.
Which presumably is largely being used, consumed in China, right?
To a large degree, yes. Yeah. Though it's flowing through globally. I mean, other big steel producers globally are doing very nicely at the moment.
Mm.
So this sort of post-COVID, can we say post-COVID? We're not quite post-COVID.
No, but no we're not.
the economic recovery is very solid.
Yep.
Good for steel producers, fantastic for iron ore miners. Can it keep on going? Clearly not at this level, but who's going to forecast the iron ore price from here?
I was going to say, you say clearly not, and then it's like, well, you know, forecasters are forecasts are very hard to make, so we'll wait and see. And look, you know, a little bit of work there. I think we discussed last week that the previous high was in 2011. You can't do a straight inflation because it's all in US dollars, and if you do it in inflation basis, it's the only inflation calculator I've got is Australian dollars at the moment. But it, you know, it said to me it'd be more like 230 US would be a record if you were to do it in real terms. I need to go back and do some work around the currency conversion to see how it really pans out for people on the ground and how much of a difference it really is. But just a reminder there that, you know, I think we sometimes get a little focused on record numbers rather than records in actual true value.
Fair enough.
All right, Mark. Well, look, remaining somewhat with iron ore, this week the Rio AGM was in Perth. I must admit I nearly stumbled into that by accident. I was at a I was at another event which was underneath the Rio one, and I nearly marched up the stairs. Plenty of security there to stop me. Now, it sounds like I missed a pretty colourful event.
Well, look, interesting, we've just spoken about iron ore prices. The iron ore market and the record profits that Rio has been generating barely rated a mention. The theme was they'd had a year of extremes. So operationally, they're doing fine. Financially, they're doing very well off the back of iron ore prices, but all entirely overshadowed by the continuing concerns around the destruction of the Juukan Gorge caves, what that's done to their license to operate. That's overwhelmingly the focus for Rio. So we had more apologies. In fact, I think we probably had more apologies from Rio than any other company I can ever ever recall. And it's very genuine. You know, I've spent time with the top people in the company, including the new CEO, Jakob Stelsham. And there's this, I think, a very genuine desire to rectify the damage they've done to their reputation. You know, Rio used to be seen as a leader in dealing with issues like Aboriginal heritage and its environmental credentials and so on, and they want to get back there. But in the meantime, shareholders said, well, we're not happy with what you've done. In particular, shareholders were not happy with the fact that the three executives who left last year, including the previous CEO, J.S. Jacques, they were able to retain their long-term incentives, which were worth tens of millions of dollars, despite overseeing all the damage that's been done because of the Juukan Gorge issue. The board has already heard that. They've already announced that they've put in place a new remuneration policy. So the vote at the AGM, 61% against acceptance of the remuneration report.
Yeah, which is a big number.
A very big protest vote. And now, essentially symbolic. You know, it doesn't sort of in itself change anything. But yes, it sent a very strong signal to the board. And the new remuneration policy that they've already developed gives the board a lot more discretion, so that if in future a chief executive was to do something that damages their reputation, the board has discretion to take away incentives that they might have previously earned. Plus, they've built in, for determining short-term incentives, it now includes consideration of ESG, that acronym we keep on talking about, environmental, social and governance issues.
Well, we have to keep talking about it. I mean, it's amazing. You've just outlined it. Operationally, obviously you can't say it's operationally perfect because they had this Juukan Gorge incident and that is an operational issue. But nevertheless, operating at full tilt, unlike, other countries, financially, absolute windfall. So, when the price is this high, you want to be taking advantage of it, and they're absolutely doing that. In days gone by, there wouldn't be much except praise. And yet here we are. Oh, it's this other matter that's there, and I'm not criticising that. It's just fascinating that it's a huge difference these days.
Mm. The other thing that came up a lot was where to from here. A lot of work's being done on that particular issue around Aboriginal heritage, but also the question about who's going to lead this business. And they've acknowledged that they need more Australian residents on their board of directors, and they need more people with mining experience. Mm. In fact, one of the current directors is Megan Clark, who used to run CSIRO, used to be a director of BHP. There was actually a significant protest against her re-election as well. There was a 25% no vote, and that's because she was chair of the Sustainability Committee.
That's right, okay, yeah.
Yes, and therefore the critics said, well, look, she has more responsibility for what happened at Juukan Gorge. The board said, okay, we hear you. You've lodged this protest, but one, we need some continuity on the board.
Correct.
I mean, the chairman is leaving next year. A couple of other directors have just retired. They've got a new chief executive. But also made the extraordinary acknowledgement, Megan Clark is the only person on the board with any mining experience.
Mm-hmm, right.
So they readily acknowledged we need people who are Australians and we need people who know about mining, which, gee whiz, I would have thought that was blindingly obvious from a long while ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, pretty fascinating. And, you know, again, I'm just, it's curious about the whole, you know, the cleaning out the place of all these people who've obviously done a terrific job in certain ways and then fail. And I guess that's the question. In these companies, I guess they're just meant to know that, you can't make those mistakes. There's no learning curve on that one.
And very quickly, one more.
Yeah.
The old question of will you shift your head office out of London?
Yes, came up, did it?
The short answer is no. But they kept on, they emphasised there's only 130 people that work in their head office.
Right.
In fact, they've got way more people in Perth, Brisbane, Montreal, Singapore, other operational centres. So I don't think we can expect any movement on that front.
No, well, they may look a little out of touch. But it was interesting, Mark, that the AGM was in Perth. I think we're thinking the last time it was in Perth was in a boom time, you know, 10 years or so ago. And, you know, I'm obviously curious, is Perth, are they holding it in Perth because it's a boom again? Or are they holding it in Perth because it's a long way to travel for all those fund managers who might make life difficult at AGM and may not want to get trapped for 2 weeks of isolation if they came here?
And I'm sure these things are scheduled a long way ahead. But it was also a decade ago when Rio and the WA government was hosting visits from people at the very top of the Chinese government.
Yeah.
Coming out here and signing all sorts of agreements.
Yeah, that's true. And Chogham was around then as well. Yeah, no, quite something. Okay, now moving on. Mark, the infrastructure and energy projects, infrastructure and energy projects have hit the news with funding announcements ahead of the federal budget.
Yep, Josh Frydenberg will hand down his budget next week. And as I say, be doing pretty nicely with the help of money off the iron ore boom. And they've foreshadowed about $1.3 billion for WA infrastructure projects, which will just add to, do we call that a boom? There's a lot of money being poured into infrastructure here.
Yeah.
One aspect that I found quite intriguing, the single biggest chunk of that is for Metronet projects, including the Armidale Railway Line.
Mm.
I don't know if people realise this, but the plan is to build an elevated railway.
Yep.
Through parts of that, through areas like Queen's Park and Cannington. So it'll be an above-ground train station. And they've also decided to do the same thing around Armidale going down to Byford. So there's going to be elevated train stations. Now, this is not something we've seen in Perth, and I think it's going to really change the tone of those areas. I know locally there's been some concern about it.
Yep.
So I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what sort of reaction that gets when awareness of that increases. And then other ones, you know, Great Eastern Highway, Reed Highway, another bridge over the Mandurah Estuary. So more money pouring in for infrastructure. So good times for contractors if they can find the staff to build
exactly
all these things.
Labour. And this is the problem, isn't it, that, you know, it always comes, you know, in a rush at the wrong moment because, you know, for various reasons. I mean, this is really political reasons, I think, in this case, mismatching against overstimulus, potentially, and existing boom times up north. I mean, you know, it's all coming to a bit of a crunch. Anyway, with a bit of luck, maybe, because I do think we've got maybe that housing boom is going to settle a little bit with the stimulus ending off, and maybe this comes in to ride through and carry construction, and I know residential housing construction and building train lines are two different things, but perhaps some of that labour is similar, who knows.
The other area that got some federal government money was hydrogen projects.
Oh yeah.
That's obviously, it's a topic we've discussed many times, and I guess a lot of people are saying, interesting concept, you know, when's it going to become real? Well, the federal government's stumped up about $100 million for three different projects, two of which are in Western Australia. One of them is in the Midwest. This will be run by ATCO and Australian Gas Infrastructure Group. The other one will be up near Karratha. It'll be run by Yara, who've got the big fertiliser plant up there, and an energy group called ENGIE. Now, the core of it, producing hydrogen, you just need a very big electrolyser. to extract the hydrogen from the water. So in both of these projects, they're going to build 10 megawatt electrolyzers. Again, the key to these things, I guess when you're sort of, hydrogen sounds sort of very new and exciting, but really, you just build a big electrolyzer, in one case, in the middle of a big wind farm.
Yep.
Hence the term green hydrogen, because it's the production of the hydrogen is powered from renewables. In that case, the hydrogen will be blended with natural gas and go into our pipelines.
Yep.
With the project up north, that's where the hydrogen will be used to produce ammonia, which is already produced as part of Yara's operations up there. So, look, this is the first, a significant step in, I guess, making hydrogen real.
Yeah, look, it's very welcome. And, I mean, I think this is one of those areas where, you know, for once there's a bit of alignment. There's corporate alignment, there's government alignment, and there's a global alignment. You know, it seems to be that this is the technology that people are accepting will be the answer, and we're a good place to produce it. You know, it makes sense for, you know, people who do LNG to potentially become producers of hydrogen. There's some similarities. We're a very isolated market, and there's a potential for us to, you know, I think this is where the state government has to show some leadership, for us to become a user of hydrogen faster than other places as a sort of trial and experiment. And obviously we've got the renewable resources. There is one thing that people don't talk about, Mark, and I'm always intrigued by this green hydrogen. I don't know how much water is required to run, you know, to run through that plant that will produce that amount, but it's a lot. And you're taking seawater, presumably. You're treating that and, you know, and make it fresh water to then electrolyze it. And this is taking the Binnenup plant, and at a scale that's much, much greater. So I'm curious, because, you know, you pump that super saline water waste out to the sea, there'll be environmental issues around that, so it's not quite green. Or you pump it on land and, you know, potentially it becomes a salt resource, potentially. But only, you know, there are places, obviously, up around Dampier, and Burrup Peninsula is a good place where you could do it. So potentially there's that, but I'm not quite sure of the Midwest. So I'm not hearing that spoken about. And I'm curious, because I've asked that question of a couple of proponents and they're like, oh, yeah, that. I don't want to talk about it. So, you know, I'm just, like everything, it's not the perfect, there's not a net, you know, you just put some electricity into some water and you get this perfect answer. Okay. So anyway, I throw that out there as a, you know, to see if there is some sort of record of what is taking place on that side of things.
Well, look, I agree that's not an issue or an aspect that has come to the fore. So let's keep an eye on that one.
Yeah. And Mark, there's been some further news on another big energy project.
So Vikas Rumbal, he came to Perth as one of the original backers of the Burrup Fertilisers project.
Yeah, which is now Yarra's, right?
Which is now Yarra. And his company, Perdaman, they've been doing a range of things around WA in property and other areas, but their big one is a urea project. That's an ingredient in fertiliser. We're talking about $4.3 billion here. Now, Vikas Rumbal and his team have been working on this for a long time now, but it seems to be getting close to sign off. They announced during the week a 20-year offtake agreement with Incitec Pivot, or their fertiliser business. So that's a significant step forward. They've already announced an engineering consortium, including Clough, to build the plant. Now, two very big ifs still waiting here. One of them, they need to secure their funding, but all these sorts of other agreements are a precondition to that. And the other one is that they've got a gas supply agreement with Woodside, but it's for gas from the Scarborough project. So Woodside needs to press go on Scarborough before Perdaman gets their gas supply. So, you know, a couple of big question marks there. But, gee, that's a pretty exciting project. They're talking about kicking off construction at the start of next year. They're saying they'll need 1,500 people at the peak of construction. So another very substantial project that people should be penciling in when they look at the future of WA.
Oh, good call. That's a good one. All right. Now, shifting focus, Mark, you did a piece on Justice Ken Martin's ruling on a case brought to court by interests associated with the Crady family. And there's some implications potentially for private arbitration in this.
Look, this was an example where Crady Group, they're a substantial property owner around Perth, about 50 different properties, including up in Malaga, and one of their tenants is Weatherford, big international sort of oil field services company. They had a dispute over the terms of the lease and how much Weatherford was paying, so they decided to go to private arbitration. And you know, a lot of people do this. Rather than going through the courts, you go off to arbitration, it's all private, you know, you choose your arbitrator, etc. Karate Group lost that case, so then they decided to go to the Supreme Court. Their argument was that the arbitration process was flawed, and therefore it should be reviewed. But Justice Ken Martin, one of the more senior and experienced Supreme Court judges, was particularly unimpressed. And he said that there's a concern here that a lot of people are effectively getting two bites of the cherry.
Yeah.
You have a crack at arbitration. If that doesn't work, you try and do it through the courts. He essentially said that this was an appeal against the arbitrator's ruling, dressed up as an appeal about the process. But he said, look, he did a detailed review of it, and of course this took the amount of time it probably would have taken to have heard the case in its entirety.
And the same cost.
And he said, look, the process was fine. It was a two-day hearing. Everybody got to present their evidence. Everybody had a chance to review it. No issues at all. And he said, I'm fed up. And in fact, he called it a, quote, this farcical position should no longer be entertained. He said, where the backdoor strategy is unsuccessfully deployed in future, it should be met with a punitive cost sanction. So basically he's saying to people, if you come up before me in future and try this on again, you know, you might be suffering a penalty there.
Yeah.
He called it the last refuge of the desperate. So some very strong language there for a Supreme Court ruling, and effectively saying that people that who have these attempted challenges against arbitrators' rulings, you know, it's undermining efforts to try and establish arbitration, as it's meant to be quick, relatively inexpensive, and definitive.
Yeah.
And yet it ends up being none of those things if people then turn around and go back to the courts.
Yeah, right. And look, I guess, you know, he's seeing a trend and he's trying to reverse that trend, I suppose. And I guess, you know, well, look, anyway, it's just fascinating. I presume that going to arbitration would typically be within a leasing deal, wouldn't it? That you know, if at the end of that, if in the agreement, it would have, and if parties disagree on something, they go to arbitration, right? So it'd be part of the agreement.
Absolutely. And similarly with big construction projects, you know, as part of the original contract, you know, they'll put in there a clause about dispute resolution. And often that will specify that they'll go to mediation, and they all might even specify the forum that they go to.
Yes.
But this is an example where a lease agreement is signed, say, 10 years ago. The world might have moved on. And some of the feedback I've had from lawyers is that arbitration is not working as effectively.
Yeah, right.
Or it doesn't always work very well. And it's not so much a we didn't like the ruling, it's we don't think the process was run properly. Mm. And that was certainly the argument here.
Yep.
And in fact, look, I think we might hear more on this because next week Business News is hosting the former Chief Justice, Wayne Martin.
Yeah.
And he now works as an arbitrator and mediator. So I'll be fascinated to get a bit more insight from him about, you know, how the system is working.
Absolutely. And that's Wednesday morning, so I don't know that you can buy a ticket to that, but if you probably if you get in today or at the weekend, you might have a chance. Not sure. Mark, house prices are buoyant in Perth, but it's still recorded the slowest growth of all the states.
Look, once again, we have the official stats from CoreLogic and from REWA, and yes, they do show a pretty, or a certainly very healthy property market in Perth, But the stats don't quite bear out a lot of the talk we've been hearing about a boom in the residential property market. So, for instance, in the month of April, Perth median house price in Perth was up 0.8%. And incidentally, that meant that, according to REWA, the median pushed above $500,000 for the first time since several years ago. It's recovered. But that 0.8% in Perth nationally was up 1.8%, Sydney 2.4%, Adelaide 2%, Brisbane 1.7%. Melbourne more than us.
I mean, Sydney's median house price is nearly double ours.
Yeah, yeah.
It's extraordinary.
But look,
especially extraordinary when you think in the boom at one point, Perth's median house price was above Sydney's.
Mm. But look, I think reflecting on this, I think we can say what's happening in Perth is actually a good thing. You know, we don't want boom bust.
No.
You know, if there's good, solid, steady growth, I think that's a pretty good outcome.
Yeah.
And in fact, so April, it was the ninth consecutive month where we've had a price increase in Perth. And over that period, up 9.1%.
Yeah, right.
So that's good, solid growth.
Pretty strong. Yeah. And I mean, it is coming off a very low base, and so there's plenty to be gained. And look, I think you're right, Mark. I mean, I think the statistics are accurate, because anecdotally, the demand has been really strong, but the supply was weak, and as people have seen the house prices lifting, the supplies come through and kind of dampen the price. So, you know, I think supply and demand is working actually quite well at the moment. I'm hearing there's even slight softening right now, where because investors have come in, but so have the people who are willing to sell. And I guess with less immigrants coming in, it's a more finite market. It seems to be more balanced. Now, Mark, there were some interesting private deals in this past week. Let's start with Go West Tours, which sold for a tidy sum, I think up to $114 million.
I just love these stories. A family down in Bunbury that started off with a second-hand bus and has now got this great business. They've just sold it for, you know, if they meet all their performance targets, up to $114 million. So it was started off by Stan Halst. I'm not sure about the pronunciation there. And he now runs the business with his son, David. They've got about almost 300 buses, nine depots, generated $46 million in revenue last year. Mm. Not a high-profile business, but clearly a success story. Now bought by the listed company, SeaLink Travel Group, which runs metro buses and runs ferries to Rottnest and Captain Cook Cruises and so on.
Right.
So all sorts of things.
And just briefly, Mark, I mean, do we know, I mean, when we say up to $114 million, did they give any discretion around that price, or is that kind of the biggest headline?
They gave a, because it's a listed company, they gave a full breakdown. So look, $72 million cash up front.
Right, gee.
So that's locked in. If that's all they get, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But there, look, another... 40-odd million tied to their performance and earnings over the next couple of years.
Got it.
But look, they got a lot of contracts with the government to run school bus services, a lot of contracts in the resource sector.
Yep.
So it just sounds like a good, solid, recurring revenue.
Mm.
And then another...
Because it's often been a fraught sector, those bus, you know, so it's good news.
The tourist buses in particular.
Yeah.
And then the other one, in the property sector, KBH Group, they've got five lock-up storage facilities around Perth, just sold them for $84 million.
Mm.
So that's one of those areas where it's just good, solid, recurring revenue. You've got all your customers that come in and sign up and put all their excess stuff in there.
And a bit of a land bank as well, usually, those things.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Now, Mark, finally, former Alcoa boss Michael Parker has become CEO of Freo Ports.
You don't often see people make a shift, in this case, sort of a very significant shift from one industry to another.
Mm.
But Michael Parker's done it. He was managing director and chair of Alcoa of Australia.
Yeah, right.
So,
And I would say normally the person who has that job, that's the last job they have as an executive, right? That's our experience from the last two,
yes,
for sure. Alan Kransberg and Wayne Osborne. They pretty much stepped out of executive after they ran those things.
Yep, yep. So, look, Michael left. There were a couple of several changes at Alcoa in the past year or so. Mm. And Bob Dupnow, recruited by the government to run from Antwerp Ports.
Mm.
So, you know, bringing some really good corporate experience and a fresh perspective. And I would have thought, you know, dealing with a global corporation, Alcoa is one of those businesses where they've got a lot of assets in Western Australia, but all the decision making sits back in the US.
Yeah, and they have some assets down around Kwinana as well, right?
Where they got the refinery in Kwinana.
Yeah. Which interestingly, and I was going to say, so I mean Freo Ports, you've got the state government wants to the new West Port at Coburn. I've always had the impression that Freo Ports is less than enthusiastic about that development. It's always believed that the inner harbour with some supplementary work around the outer harbour would be fine for the next 50 years. So maybe this is the government just putting in someone that they feel might be more attuned to their plans. Any thoughts?
Well, that's
a question without notice.
It is, yep. I don't know. Michael might be a brave man and might challenge the established thinking on that one. But I don't know what his thoughts are around that.
I'm only speculating. It's only just, you know, if you want to. I mean, in the end, I presume Freo Ports will run the whole thing. So, you know, anyway, we'll see. I don't have a lot more information on that. I was just curious. All right, thanks, Mark. That was great. Our next event is from our Politics and Policy series featuring Michaela Cash, Attorney General, Minister for Industrial Relations and Deputy Leader of the Government in the Senate. Please join us for breakfast on Wednesday, June 9 at Crown Perth to hear from Senator Cash, who is responsible for some of the Morrison government's most significant priorities ahead of what is shaping up to be a hard-fought federal election campaign. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Mark My Words with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer from Business News. For more information, please go to businessnews.com.au/podcasts. And to receive these regularly, search for Business News WA in iTunes or SoundCloud.